All right, our next presentation, it's an honor to welcome Kelly Williams, the Senior Director of Engineering and Technology Policy in the NAB's Technology Department. Kelly joined the NAB in 1989. During his tenure, he has managed a diverse portfolio of technical and regulatory issues, including RF exposure, Stella, the V-chip, closed captioning, 2 gigahertz BAS relocation and video description, and EAS. He represents broadcasters' interests on various industry technology and government advisory committees and currently serves on the FCC's Communications Security Reliability and Interoperability Council. Say that three times real fast. And the Video Programming Accessibility Advisory Committee. Prior to joining NAB, Kelly worked at WHMM-TV, now WHUT, a PBS station in Washington, D.C. Kelly has a BS in Electrical Engineering from Howard University. He has 3 grown daughters and resides in Washington, D.C. Kelly Williams.
Well, needless to say, I drink a lot of coffee, so I spend all my time dealing in the world of Washington. So, is everybody awake this morning? All right, that's good. So we got a lot of stuff to go through. I wanted to leave some time for questions. And after I put this together, this Chinese proverb that everybody has heard this, saying that may you live in interesting times. Well, this is a really difficult and challenging time to be a television engineer. And as I went through all of this stuff, it kind of reinforced it. So I researched this because I thought this was from Confucius. Turns out nobody really knows where this come from. It also turns out this is a curse. It's part of a 3-part curse. The other part of this, the second part of this is, may you come to the attention of those in authority. Well, for us, that's the government. And frankly, and some of the stuff I'm going to show you, this is not such a good thing. And then the last one, which there's some differences in translations here. The most common one is, may you find what you're looking for. But the other one is, may you get what's coming to you. So, you know, in modern English, they really say, yeah, I guess this really is kind of a curse. All right, so we're going to go through, I actually made a long list of stuff and came up with more slides than I could possibly do in the time allotted. So try to pick some of the high points. We're going to talk about the calm, nothing calm about the Calm Act, and I'm sure you've all heard the litany of jokes about the Calm Act. 7 and 13 gigahertz BAS band sharing, accessibility, which at one point was taking up about half of my job. And if you're not clear on what that is, that's TV for the blind and radio for the deaf. IP captioning, these are things that come under accessibility. And then we'll end up talking a little bit about what's in the incentive auction, NPRM. As Kevin mentioned, that's a 205-page document with an accompanying 20-page appendix written by 4 PhD economists. I just kind of skimmed that part. All right, and then we'll do some questions at the end. So, Calm Act. Now, I'm not going to talk a lot about the technical aspects of Calm Act. I'm going to talk about the regulatory part. There's a session later on today that's going to go into some things about the technical part of the Calm Act. But what really doesn't get a lot of talk about is sort of what is the bones of what's required on that. So let's go through a minute of history. Calm stands for Commercial Advertisement Loudness Mitigation. It was passed by Congress in December of 2010. It requires essentially that ATSC A85, which is a recommended practice on managing loudness, both sort of in a production and in a distribution situation. Everybody who is responsible for this should go out and get this document. It's available for free at www.atsc.org. The FCC adopted rules implementing the act in December 2011. They take effect on December 13th, 2012. So if you haven't thought about how you're going to comply with this act in your station, today would be an excellent time to start. So what does it do? The Act requires programmers, and I'm paraphrasing here, there's a long list of what constitutes a programmer, and in our case, local television station is the programmer here, to technically manage a loudness so that commercials are not objectionably louder than the programming that they're in. And it also requires that you use measurement techniques contained in ITU BS 1771. So there's sort of two things in 1771. One is there is equipment that complies with that, and that also gives you some measurement techniques on how to use that equipment as well. The key thing to keep telling yourself, and I'm not going to go into this in depth, loudness equals dial norm. Loudness equals dial norm. Does everybody in here know what dial norm is? No. Okay, dial norm is a setting. Okay, two people, three people, all right. Dial norm is a four, five, yeah, okay, well, at least, all right. Don't be shy, raise your hands. Even if you don't know, raise your hand anyway. Dial norm is a setting in your ATSC encoder. And, all right, that guy knows twice. He must have two stations. Like I said, I didn't really go into the technology of it, but you measure loudness, the measurements that you get in LKFS, equals the dial norm setting that you put in your equipment. I said I didn't want to go down that path, but just keep telling yourself that over and over and over and over again. Loudness equals dial norm. So what does this mean? You have to manage the loudness of the locally inserted programming or commercials to your programming. This is not necessarily difficult. But it's a new thing for us as broadcasters to have to worry about. So regulatorily, there are a couple of things, and the regulations are short, but they're very complex and extremely vague. In some ways, that's good for us and what this means. So essentially, as long as you use some commercially reasonable manner to manage this, you are deemed to be in compliance. So it's not like having a master control operator, if you still have one, riding a gain knob is not a commercially reasonable manner. So as long as you employ equipment to do this, equipment that complies with BS 1771 is readily available in the marketplace. But you are deemed to be in compliance. So when we see this term deemed to be in compliance, essentially it means there's a presumption that you're in compliance unless you get a complaint. If you get a complaint, you need to prove that you actually comply with the rules. So there is what's called a safe harbor built into this, into the FCC rules. And essentially what that means is if you're getting a network feed from someone else, the person who is sending you that programming, if there are commercials embedded in that program, they can certify to you that they comply with the COM Act and the COM Act rules. If they do that, then you are okay. But if you're inserting local commercials, you still have to manage that process as well. Now, what happens for uncertified programming? Because you're going to get syndicated programming, which people are going to go, I have national commercials in there, and I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know, COMAC, SMALMAC, I don't know. So in order to do that, and this is where it gets a little weird. You have to spot check the programming. Now, this applies to larger stations. These are stations, the rules define large stations as stations that made more than $14 million in calendar year 2011. And what you have to do is spot check 100% of your programming annually for 2 years. And you have to finish these spot checks by December of next year. Now, if you're a small station, if you make less than $14 million, you don't have to do this. Let's talk about what a spot check is. And this is where it gets a little problematic. You have to monitor 24 hours of programming with an audio loudness meter that uses A85 techniques. Now, there are devices out there that will help you do this. And then you look at that and you see if there are any commercials, any issues with variances in loudness. Now, there's a problem with this. The problem is the devices that do this collect an enormous amount of data, an enormous amount of data per, let's say, hour, however you want to do it. So over 24 hours, you will collect an enormous amount of data. So there are issues about how it's humanly possible to actually sort through all of that and figure out if there is any problems with loudness. So SCTE, which if you guys are not familiar with this, this is the SBE of the cable industry. They are working on a recommended practice for how to implement this, and we think that the FCC will be very happy to let people do it this way. You can imagine as a cable operator who deals with literally hundreds of upstream feeds, upstream programming feeds, that this could be a problem for them. It's less of a problem for a TV station, but it is a problem nonetheless. We have two documents that'll help you out. We have a council memo, which is written by a legal department. That's a members-only thing. Sorry, if you're not a member, you don't get to see that. Us engineers, a little bit more friendly. We have a one that's open on the engineering part, or the technology part of NAB's website that talks about some best practices there. Encourage you all to do that. Encourage you all to go get A85, read it, you know, put on a pot of coffee and read through it, and then look at the best practices. That's it for the COM Act. Like I said, a lot of this presentation, I really just want to sort of make you aware of what's going on as we move forward. So 713 gigahertz BAS sharing. Has anybody heard about this? Been aware of it? Okay. Hopefully, Chuck, you don't count, actually. You know all of this stuff. So some of you may have gotten requests to coordinate on this. In August of last year, the FCC adopted rules that allowed non-broadcasters to come into the 7 and 13 gigahertz band. Those bands had previously been exclusive for broadcasters. The reason they did that is because the wireless industry and other telecom industries have eaten up all of their microwave frequencies. It's congested, and they're like, well, look at the broadcast band. That's not being heavily used. When the FCC went, sure, you can share. By 7 and 13, I mean the 6, 8.75 and 71.25 and the 12.7 to 13.2 bands. One more. Okay, so what do we have in there? Most people have STLs and what used to be called ICRs. That regulatory term isn't there, but I still use it. Is anybody doing TV pickup in 7 here? It's kind of rare, mostly. Some people do it. There are a few people, ran across a few people who are doing it with helicopters as a backup. The issue here is that the new rules took effect on October 27th of last year. Part 101, which is the rule part that regulates all microwave users except broadcasters. Cable uses in another part as well. They have already begun filing applications to put links in these bands. The problem is that there is no really accepted coordination practice except for the standard coordination that's in Part 101. So NAB, SBE, and a group called NSMA, and the NSMA is the National Spectrum Managers Association. This is an association of people that does coordination mostly with fixed point-to-point microwave, telcos, railroads, these kind of folks. We're working on a coordination RP. The reason that this is important is because while these Part 101 users cannot put a fixed link in an area where you're doing TV pickup, they can put it in an area that's adjacent to that. And to most of them, TV pickup is a completely foreign concept. And one of them said, what do you mean you pick up your transmitter and you move it? It's like, well, not only do we move it, but it's actually in a truck. So we move it around a lot. There are a couple of things in there. This requires, the rules now require broadcasters to register their receive-only sites in the ULS. The ULS is the Wireless Bureau's database. All of your microwave licenses are in the ULS. Now, the problem is the FCC was supposed to have come out with a public notice establishing the deadline for when to register this. There's a disconnect here because they're already accepting applications, but yet they haven't required broadcasters yet to register their receive-only sites. I cannot tell you how important it is that you go do this, because the coordinators will go into the ULS, look at what's in there, and that's what they will do their analysis based on. I weekly send an email to the guy at the FCC who's writing this thing going, how's it going? And it's kind of not going. So anyway, they're held up in an administrative process. There is a filing fee for this, but because the government requires you to do that, the FCC rules say that that fee is waived, and apparently they're having some problems writing that down in a public notice. I'm not sure what the issue is, but anyway, so there's an action item here for everybody. As I mentioned, you need to register your receive-only sites. For at least the one fellow that's doing TV pickup in there, you really need to make sure that you do that. There's another issue in here which is very important. A large majority of the BIS licenses, actually I shouldn't say a large majority, a third to a half are incorrect. Now, a lot of that has to do with the fact that many years ago, if you've had an established BIS license in this band, the Media Bureau used to keep this in a database. It used to be something called the Auxiliary Bureau. Anybody remember that? Been around long enough to remember the Auxiliary Bureau? All right. But all of that got sent over to the Wireless Bureau. The Media Bureau kept different information on your license than the Wireless Bureau did. So what the Wireless Bureau did, since they didn't know what to do with it, they dropped a lot of the information. Or they didn't know how to deal with it at all. So an interesting number of fixed links, BAS fixing links, have no endpoints on their license. This is really critically important because you don't protect the transmitter, you protect the receiver. I encourage all of you to go into the ULS, look at all of your licenses, and check for endpoints, contact information. The contact information is vital. Addresses are vital because Part 101 of the rules requires this new entrant to send you something called a PCN, prior coordination notification. It's a letter saying, we intend to build a link from here to here. Please tell if it's a problem. If you don't respond, they assume it's not a problem. The unfortunate part is that fixing some of this might cause you to incur a fee to fix it, but the fee to fix it is much better than have somebody turn on a fixed link and step on your STL because they didn't know the receive site was where it was or what the antenna characteristics were or something like this. There's a link here, which please don't bother to write down. It should be in the PowerPoint, which is being distributed. This will take you to a utility on the FCC's webpage. You need to know your station FRN number, I'm sorry, your station facility ID number in order to use this, and you can put it in and it will show you all the BAS licenses that the FCC believes that you have. For some stations that have been in existence, you may be holding licenses that you no longer use. You want to go ahead and purge those out of there, things like that. All right, just sip a coffee and then we'll move on to accessibility. So accessibility is a real interesting thing. In 2010, Congress passed something called, what we refer to as a CVAA. It's the 21st Century Communications and Video Accessibility Act. Essentially, it requires video, they define two terms, video program owners, video program distributors. TV stations are, in some cases, both. Sometimes you're a distributor, sometimes you own what you distribute, sometimes you don't. But this rule applies, this law applies to television stations. And essentially it means that you have to make the programming you send accessible in sort of three basic areas. Generally it's accessible in three different areas. This bill was exceptionally far-reaching. It also impacts consumer electronics manufacturers. So it requires them, for example, to change remote controls, to create a user interface, a TV a guide, for example, and a set-top box that a blind person can use, things like that. It's quite a far-reaching act. As far as the local TV stations, it did three things, the first of which, it reinstated something that's called video description rules. Video description is a narration track which describes what's going on in the programming. So it would be, the narration is in between the dialogue. So it would be something like Bob enters a room. The room has three chairs. One's green, one's red. There's a table on the left. Bob sits down in the green chair next to the table. Then you hear the dialogue. Then comes in. This is video description. It's actually kind of cool. You can go out and buy DVDs. Somebody's interesting, there are DVDs that have it, and you can go on and turn on and listen to it. So what the rule requires is, as of July 1st, so this has already happened, full power affiliates of the top four national networks and the top 25 DMAs have to provide about 4 hours a week of video programming. Now you may be asking, why am I bringing this up here? Because I don't think there's a top 25 market in Wisconsin. I don't think so. I could be wrong. But here's the issue. All stations in all markets are required to pass video description through if you are technically capable of doing it. Let's talk a little bit about what that means. First off, the networks will create the video description or contract to have the video description done. It will come through down your network feed. The video description will be sent on the same track where you would get Spanish. Whatever path that is from your network that you get it, that's where you will find it. If you have in your plant the ability now to put Spanish on the air, if you are putting Spanish on the air, you are technically capable of doing video description. Now, the good news is, if you are passing through the Spanish on network programming, you don't need to do anything. It's just going to show up. But if you have the ability and you sometimes do it or you do something else, then you may be deemed to have it. Again, this is one of these things where it's not really an issue unless someone complains or someone gets an inquiry to you. It's like, why don't you have video description? Well, your first answer is, we're not required to do it. We're outside the top 25 market. I think of technical capability as you have to be able to get it from the network, route it through your plant, and then you have to have a second audio service that is a second audio encoder, everything provisioned in your ATSC encoder to get this extra service out over the air. The big deal coming up, and there's still a lot of technical work to be done here, is that regardless of market, mobile TV, actually I take that back, I think it's still top 25 markets initially, mobile DTV, I think there's one station here that's mobile on the air, but for those who are thinking about it, you've got to do video description by October 2013. There are some serious technical issues on how that can happen, because they are carried differently in mobile TV just to conserve bits. So stay tuned for more info about that. Second thing for broadcast is something we commonly refer to as IP captioning. This is placing captions on programming that you put on the internet. So the rules that are adopted says if a program ran on television, it was captioned. If it runs on the internet, it must be captioned as well. These are full programs only, not clips. So for those of you who post your news clips, you can breathe. It doesn't include those. So starting September 30th, this has passed already, pre-recorded programming that is not edited for the internet, editing out commercials doesn't count, newly added to a distributor's internet program inventory. All right, so episodes that came on TV as of September 30th that are rerunning on a network or your network that you're affiliated with have to have captions on it. Now again, this is not something that a local station deals with directly. Really the network deals with this. Hulu, Netflix, Amazon, Premium, those are the ones who really have to make sure that these things are there. But there is a deadline coming in March 30, March of 2013. And this is a live or near live programming. So for those of you, is anybody in here who streams live news when it runs? As of March 2013, that has to be captioned when you put it on. Now, the new, yeah, that woke you up, didn't it? talk to your encoder manufacturers. Well, I'll get to that. I'm getting ahead of myself. So what is live and near live programming? It is programming that obviously goes live, like your news is live. There are some programs, Letterman and Leno, they're near live. So they're recorded in the afternoon, edited, and then they run within 24 hours of being taped, that kind of thing. So you need to be thinking about how that's going to happen. September 30th, I'm just going through some of the dates here. Pre-recorded programming, again, unless you guys have an archive of pre-recorded programming on your station's website, this doesn't really affect you. This is Hulu, Netflix, the networks. And for stuff that's very old, Gilligan's Island, if Gilligan's Island were to air, which was never captioned, if it airs captioned anywhere in the United States, it then has to be captioned everywhere on the internet. Again, that kind of thing typically doesn't do things, doesn't affect stations. So the action item, I think, here is for those of you who have click-throughs on your website to your networks, networks players, and that's very common. A lot of stations have that. Watch the last episode of, I don't know, something. I didn't want to pick on anyone network. On your website, you want to make sure that that click-through works and that there is a button there to turn on captioning and so forth, and that it actually works. Now, in reality, what's happening is a consumer clicks on that. It takes them off to the network's website. It's not playing through your website necessarily. But in one particular network's case, they had a different landing page for affiliates than they did for if someone went to direct to the network directly. And the version of the player on the affiliate's landing page was different than the one that was on the network, and the button to turn the captions on wasn't in that player. In that particular case, you wouldn't ultimately be liable, but someone could file a complaint against your station for not complying for those rules. So you just want to go, this takes 5 minutes of your time. Go there, click on it, look at a couple things, make sure you can turn on the captions, you can see them. For the live streaming, this is a big TBD. Most of the encoder manufacturers, for those of you who do this, you probably have an encoder that takes your video, your program video, and encodes it in a couple of different formats, and it sends off to some web contractor or CDN. You need to start talking to them about the fact that you're going to have to do this. Some of the CDNs are completely unaware of this. Interestingly, or unfortunately, however you want to think about it, the CDNs and web contractors are not regulated by the FCC. Many of them know about it, but a couple of the real big ones do. Some of them don't. So you need to start talking to them now about how this is going to, that you're going to have to do this. You need to be looking at the fact that you may need to buy or upgrade the encoders that you have. Because ideally what needs to happen is these encoders have to extract this 708 data from your video. Everybody know what 708 data is? Okay. 708 data out of your video, put it into a format which is called SMPTE time text, and send it off with the encoded video. Now, the good news is, because you're probably all thinking, wait a minute, there are 1,000 different players and 1,000 different devices, and what if somebody has an old version of Flash and it doesn't have all this computer? In actuality, that does not affect broadcasters. There is a provision in the rule, another safe harbor, is if you encode it correctly and you send it, you are deemed to be in compliance. You can actually thank yours truly for that, because I got that stuck in there. So talk to your CDNs and your web contractors about the fact that this is coming down the pipe. The last part of this is coming, but I do not know when, is this issue of making emergency information accessible to people with visual disabilities. Now, this came out of the fact that a woman died in Boston. Her dog died too, but she died because there was a boiled water alert that was crawling across the screen. She didn't see it. She drank the water. She died. So this is a big idea of how do you make those kinds of crawls that you put on, the weather crawls or general emergency crawls, accessible. The FCC has to figure out how to do that. And what's up here is sort of the language that's in here. So they have to figure out a way to do it. I was chairman of the advisory committee. That was that VPAC, it's Accessibility Committee that worked on that. I was chairman of the Emergency Information Working Group there. But then they have to promulgate rules, and they have to get those rules out by this April. When they take effect, I don't know. All right, so what does this mean? Essentially, it means you have to make the crawls talk. If you make a crawl, you've got to make it audible. Action item here. If you do not have a second audio service on your station, you need to start thinking about how you're going to do that. What's involved? Get it in your budget. Get a second encoder. Figure out how to provision it and provision it quickly. Provision it correctly. Again, I don't know the timing of this, but you should think about a year time frame, I would suspect. The act on this particular issue doesn't tell the FCC when the rules have to take an effect. On some of these issues, it said the FCC had a year to do rules, and then a year after that, that the rules had to take an effect. It doesn't say that for here, but I would think on the order of a year. I don't know. We'll be watching that and seeing how things are going. There's a gotcha here. Once you add this ability to do the emergency information, the accessible emergency information, you are by default technically capable of passing through video description. So keep that in mind. That's probably not a difficult thing or a bad thing. Because by that time you've done all the hard work and spent all the money, so you just need to make sure the video description is passed through. Okay, last and very much not least is the incentive auction NPRM. It came out, the text came out last Wednesday. It's 205 pages, as Kevin mentioned, with a thick appendix. The comments are due on December 21st. They did a really interesting thing here. It's only interesting as to us in the regulatory world. Generally what happens is when the FCC or any government agency puts out a document, any dates in that document become effective so many days after it's published in this thing called the Federal Register. There is a provision actually in the Administrative Procedures Act that says you can set a date, and as long as it gets published at least 30 days before that, then you comply with the federal rules for dates and so forth and so on. So essentially, by them setting a December 21st date, which is fairly far away, they're pretty much guaranteed that this thing will get published, you know, has to get out by November 21st. And if that doesn't happen, then something seriously goes wrong. Should it go after November 21st, it'll be 60 days after there, but December. So what's in here? Whoops. Here we go. Essentially, it's a huge document asking, I don't know, my count, about 700 different questions about auctions, how they should work, how you should design an auction, what is a reverse auction. I'm going to go over this a little bit, the repacking. There's discussion in there about the band, the 600 megahertz band plan, so that's 51 and below. Unlicensed use, people know about, you guys know about white spaces and that sort of thing. There are some rules now on how white spaces work. Most of this is going to set all of that up on its head, and it's going to need to be redone. And then the idea of if there's a repacking, how what's involved in a transition for us. So let's talk a little, just really briefly about, you know, what, for those of you that don't know, what the incentive auction model is. So there's a first part, which is a reverse auction. That's where broadcasters would say essentially how much you would accept to either get out completely or in all cases it's get off your channel. Now maybe you're going to go out of business completely or maybe decide to share with another channel. That's a decision your owners will make. If they decide to get out, then in many ways it might be over for some of you guys. But if you're going to stay, there is the other part, which is called the forward auction. And this is where the FCC will take bids from the wireless industries. They've done this many times. That's how all the wireless spectrum was done. They bid on spectrums in certain geographical areas. Now, before they can figure out what they have to sell in every market, they have to repack and try to figure out what's going on, how much spectrum is going to be available for sale in every market. So in the repacking, the FCC asks a couple of questions, important questions. And one is how to interpret Congress's mandate to preserve coverage of a station, and what does that mean? They propose to tie it to population, that you still serve the amount of the same population that you do. So again, these are all questions. They also say that you should calculate that based on the existing rules. So that's OET document 65. So that's basically Longley Rice based analysis that's used now. They propose to use that. So they want to know, is that a reasonable amount of thing? And then they also ask questions about how to actually preserve served populations. One of the interesting things here, which really got my attention, is how they intend to create a band plan for the spectrum that's auctioned. And what they want to do is, typically, wireless channels are 5 megahertz wide. They are going to pair 2 5 megahertz wide, because for those of you who don't know how this operates, wireless devices have to have an uplink band, a downlink band that are separated by some amount of spectrum. Right now, it's typically about 100 megahertz, but that's not very far when you're up at 2 gigahertz, where most of these phones operate. When you get down into the UHF band, that's actually a big chunk of spectrum that they have, and the spacing and so forth. Are any of you familiar with the Channel 51-52 controversy? So one person raising their hand. Okay. So essentially, there are wireless companies who bought spectrum on what is Channel 52. Verizon was the biggest one. And they went, oh, dang, there's a big megawatt transmitter operating next door in some markets, where they're over here operating kilowatts. So obviously, there's some interference issues. The FCC wants to talk about how to mitigate that. Their suggestion is there should be a 6 megahertz guard band between these two operations. And then, since the government doesn't like guard bands anymore because it's spectrum going fallow, what they propose is to use that spectrum for unlicensed use. Now, this begs the question about what happens to our wireless microphones. The answer to that is, I don't know. But we'll have to see how that goes on. So they see comment on all of this stuff. I have a picture here, which hopefully will make this a little bit more clear. So if someone buys, what they want to do is, they ask a lot of questions about Channel 37. As most of you know, Channel 37 is a radio astronomy band, which for years has been protected. They still talk a little bit about protecting this, but then they also talk about relocating this. Now, I don't know how you relocate radio astronomy, but that's the term they use. But the idea is that when you buy a wireless company who buys something would buy 51 paired with 36, 50 paired with 35, 40, and so forth and so on. Since these are 5 megahertz wide channels, they don't necessarily match up. So they talk about a minimum of 6 megahertz guard band, but that guard band could be as big as 8, could be as big as 10, could be as small as 4. It all depends. So they ask questions about, they don't ask questions in the NPRM about the size of the guard band. One of the commissioners, when the item was presented, asked questions, criticized him for not asking questions about whether 6 megahertz was enough. The other issue generally is, should the FCC be considering setting aside spectrum for unlicensed use at all? since the act doesn't really tell them to do that, and because while they're on license, they should just use white spaces like they do now. And again, they don't really talk about microphones in here, but it'll be up to us to bring that up. All right, folks, so that is it. If you're not worried, you probably should be. You at least have, I'm sorry, I don't mean pessimistic, BPS pessimistic, but there is a lot going on. There are a few other things going on. For anybody in here operate a C-band uplink at all? The FCC is reviewing those rules right now. I would encourage you to go look at that. We'll probably put something, for those of you who are members and get tech check, we'll have some information about that. Most of that actually seems pretty straightforward in terms of they're trying to make the licensing procedures easier on themselves and therefore easier on you. So that really isn't a bad thing there. I don't think if there's anything else coming out. That's about it. Questions? All right.
Very interesting presentation.
Thank you.
Question I have, all this garbage. Now, I'm retired, so I don't have to deal with this. Yeah. But all this garbage coming down. Question is it the useless Congress that passed this? Is it executive orders, or is it just the infinite wisdom of the FCC?
A little of both. The Accessibility Act, this accessibility thing has been what we used to call disability rights groups, and there are many of them, basically pushing Congress for about a decade, trying to get some of this stuff put into law, just like captioning was put into law. This sounds bad saying we fended it off. I mean, this is not something we necessarily are opposed to. I mean, we broadcasters are good. We like public service. This is a benchmark of what separates us from the other services. However, one of the things that we pointed out is we live in a reality where there are fewer and fewer technical and operational people in a TV plant. So these things where they say, well, digital is easier. Now that we've gone to digital, we can do anything you want. Well, you know, actually we can, but it's 150 times more complicated. Some of the things like the 7 and 13 gigahertz sharing, the FCC just woke up one morning and did it. They didn't know, nobody even asked them to do it. They just did it. They just decided, well, you know, the other people don't have enough spectrum. Let's look there. So a little bit of both.
Very interesting. And I'm involved in the cellular industry since I've been retired. And this whole auction thing and reutilization of spectrum, most of the cellular industry is pretty well saturated. You know, it's the old situation, just like broadcast. It's revenue versus the frequency you're using and population base and so on. Mm-hmm. I think there may be some interest in getting out of the 1900 down to the 700, or they always call it 700 megahertz bands. But I don't think there's that much of a demand anymore. There's so much competition in the cellular industry, and it's pretty well saturated. You know, it's that old thing, you know, you reach saturation,
right.
And it's getting there. So it'll be very interesting to see how these auctions go.
Yes.
I think the FCC and the government's looking at all this money coming in.
Oh, they're definitely looking. Ever
and
since
the cellular industry, a lot of them overcommitted to the revenue, and that's a big nut to crack.
It is. It is. Okay, behind you.
Kelly, thank you for being here today. Very, very informative. Back to the safe harbor you were talking about early in your presentation.
Mm-hmm.
And programs that are, quote unquote, certified.
Yes.
Do we have to keep on file that certification?
Yes. You like short answers?
Yeah.
I'm not sure the rules say it, but yes.
Okay.
Is
it our responsibility to ask for that certification, or is
yes.
it to be automatically given to us?
If it's not automatically given, you need to ask.
Okay. Yes. One other quick question. On the database that you suggested we go in and check.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. If there is a mistake in that database, or let's say there's frequencies that we don't use anymore and we want to get rid of,
mm-hmm.
is any change made, does that also trigger a fee?
Different fees for different changes. Some things are minor changes.
Yeah.
Some things are major changes. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head what
okay.
they are. Adding an endpoint, I believe, is a major change. And what you don't want to happen, there's some controversy, you have to talk to someone who knows more about the ULS. Some folks have told me that it may trigger another coordination, but I think that's true in most cases. So, but the issue is there, this is an existing link, and you're just correcting data. Things like addresses, I believe, are minor changes. I don't think they are.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Kelly, I have more than one question.
Okay.
The first one is concerning the CALM Act. Mm-hmm. I understand the certification process and how that's a CYA type thing for a broadcaster. Now, a lot of broadcasters, to the disdain of their network, are thinking about or contemplating solving CALM with an end-of-the-line processor.
Yeah.
Okay. How does that affect the certification process? If, as I understand it, and I'm sure it's not in the rules because it's one of those confusing things, but if somebody is certifying, they're giving you the program correct, and then you modify it through processing, you kind of let them off the hook, didn't you?
No, probably not. I don't think the FCC contemplated that specific question. As I mentioned, a lot of this is extremely vague, and in fact, some of it doesn't really make sense. I think once you're certified, the certification was an attempt to give you cover. But unless you screw it up, it's a technical term. Yeah. what I'm going through my head, so let me just spit this out. So there is an opportunity that if you use some sort of end-line product that you could screw it up. However, the point of using that type of technology is that you don't screw it up. So as long as you implement that right, you're likely not to have a problem, which means you won't generate a complaint. A lot of this really comes to play if you get a complaint, and you have to demonstrate that, yes, I complied by doing A, B, and C. And the commission is always, mostly, accommodating when you go, mea culpa, I found it, I fixed it, I'm sorry, this was new. Yeah, but I don't think putting an end-of-the-line device sort of changes anything with the certification part of it.
Well, keep lawyers employed.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Now's an excellent time to go to law school.
Yeah. The next question has to do with emergency audio. You know, the scenario where the lady drank the water that you were talking about.
Yeah.
Is that emergency audio then, as far as we're concerned, that needs to be transmitted on the same audio channel as the video descriptive audio?
That's correct. We've already laid the foundation for that, both in the video description item. We talked about this. We talked about the reality of life, not for a broadcaster. You could, given enough money and time, put seven audio channels and several audio services on your broadcast channel. The reality of life is the MVPDs, cable, satellite, they are stuck in a two audio service world. So the reality is all of these other things that come along, language, video description, emergency, they really have to function on that second audio channel. And the FCC has recognized that that's the way it's going to be for the foreseeable future.
All right, so if I follow this, then the emergency audio can replace the video descriptive audio.
Yes.
The video descriptive audio has replaced the Spanish audio.
You get to choose.
Does anybody ask the Spanish audio audience what they think of this?
No. that came up multiple times. We brought this up, your trade association brought this up, what they said is the local broadcaster can choose. So the rules, it's not actually in the rules, it's in the report and order, says if you're in a community where you are heavily second language, you may find that it's better to save your community. And what we told them is, look, the local broadcaster is the only one in the position to make that decision. The government can't, because every community is different.
Well, then does that mean that if those stations, and those would be in fairly large markets, if they choose to stay with Spanish, they're okay, they're not in violation of the video descriptive audio?
That's correct. Okay. Now, the reality is, right now, There is, I would say somewhat confidently, no program that you're going to get from your network that has both. Now, you know, next year, who knows? But the likelihood that you're faced with that decision is low for now. But if it comes up, you have the right to decide. You do not have the right to decide for emergency information, though. The emergency information has to interrupt what's ever on that second audio service. You're over there.
Kelly, you'd mentioned about registering your receive-only sites for
yes.
7 and 13.
Yes.
That also applies for 2-gig sites, because if a 2-gig site isn't registered, the AWS provider just below 2-gig has no way to protect your receive site.
That's correct. That's a good practice. And that was, if that point didn't come across, you should register all of your receive-only sites
right.
and check all of your license data.
The other thing is, as far as modifying links that didn't have receive sites on them,
mm-hmm.
the commission gave everybody an opportunity to fix that
right.
at no charge.
Right.
Most people didn't do it.
That's correct.
Now if you do it, you do have to go through another PCN process, and there is a fee to correct your license. It's
yes.
a major change.
Yeah. Yeah, it was in 2003, I think. I don't remember exactly, but that's right. Yes.
Kelly, excellent presentation, by the way.
Thanks.
A couple of questions on the auction as things have developed and the NPRM has come out, and I spend a little bit of time in D.C. like you do. There have been some discussions about how many channels could be acquired for an auction if no broadcasters came to the party, and I'm wondering if you have any feeling on that.
Thank you for bringing that up.
Uh-huh.
I left that out.
Well, I'm going to give you a compound question, then I'll mm-hmm. shut up because it's all related. Second is discuss a little bit of the impact perhaps on the translator world and the low-power world, because that's related to my first question. If they just mm-hmm. if broadcasters don't shut, there's still quite a bit of stuff that can happen. And then finally, what would NAB like people to do to activate on this issue now that the NPRM is out? And I think that probably goes to the comment cycle. Thank you.
Sure. So there are a couple of things. One is, the answer to your first question is the FCC hasn't said anything. They just ask questions. But I think what's really important about your first question is, the reality is there could be different amounts of spectrum transferred to the wireless industry in different geographical areas in the country. I'm glad you brought this. This is a really important concept, and I left it out of here. So for us, we think of DMAs. The wireless industry thinks of different geographical things. But what you could have in an adjacent market, you could have a plan like what I showed here, and then the market next door, you have a completely different plan. So they said that's an important concept. FCC said that's an important concept because if they said they were going to clear the same amount of spectrum nationally, then they would be held to the market that had the least available spectrum. So that's sort of an underlying concept that they have. But to me, that creates a situation where you have a potentially unmanageable. I don't know how they would manage this, where you could have 3-5 megahertz channels in one market, in places like when you get to the East Coast, where our markets are spaced like 30, 40, 50 miles apart, the next adjacent market, like Baltimore and Washington, are 35 miles apart. They're two different DMAs. And one DMA over, you have a completely different channel plan. And that seems impossible to manage from a government standpoint. So, which leads into your next question is, well then, where do we find the spectrum for the low power services? So it's sort of in my mind, and I'm giving you my opinion, I'm giving NAB's opinion. Really translators, so first by statute, there's a thing called a Class A low power station. They are by statute protected and they're included in this process. When you get out of there, you have translators and low power TVs. Essentially the FCC doesn't treat them at all in this. Which could, and again, this is sort of my interpretation, is saying they're going to look and see what's left, and some of them are just going to get flushed. I don't know what else they can possibly do. Having said that, translators in particular play a really important role, particularly when you get to the Midwest and the Southwest. Translators are very important. Low powers are very important. In a lot of communities, they're the only television that's there. One might suspect that in those communities, there's plenty of available spectrum, so they won't be impacted. But you never really know. I mean, you know, common sense kind of tells you wireless services, spectrum for more wireless services are needed in more densely populated area. They tend not to be a lot of low power TV. Translators or low power TVs in densely populated areas, but that's also not a universally true statement. It depends. So the answer is, I don't know. we'll have to see. I mean, some of this, you know, they said they want to complete this in a year. I don't know how they'll get through one round. The other issue too is, there's a companion item to this, which has to do with spectrum caps by the bidders, and who can bid and things like that. I suppose there is some world in which somebody could come along and go, you know what? Anybody should be allowed to bid. And if I bid and I win, and I could put a low-power TV station there. I don't know. That's speculation on my part, but it's complicated. Okay. Yes.
Moving back to the accessibility for a moment.
Sure.
Is it necessary that the crawls talk, or would we be deemed to comply if we were to trigger some other alert to let the impaired person know that there is information there to go seek the seek information because something else is being presented visually on the screen?
Yes, they want both. So we vetted this through an advisory committee, and NAB has a technology advisory committee as well, and I sort of vetted this through a lot of them, and trying to think of, for me, because I'm an engineer, what's the least technically burdensome, and then the other thing is figuring out what this other source would be. So really the accessibility groups want both. But there is a really important, what they said is, and this makes some sense, we hear the beep, beep, beep that you run before you crawl, but we have no clue what it says. So in some cases, in some communities, there are places that they can go to and they can check. They can go on the web. A lot of these people are older people. They don't have web experience or web access. Because actually one of the other things was, could we send it an out-of-band data channel that you could access through some other device, and that may be something coming down the road. But it was clear that this was something that was going to come along pretty quickly, so a year, 2 year process, and that seems like a logical way to do. But I'm sure as part of the rulemaking when it comes out, the commission will ask all these questions. All right, oops, another one. We're eating into the break a little bit. I hope you guys don't mind. I'm fine to, you know. Go ahead.
Oops. How long do we have to keep local archives to show that we are in compliance with the COM Act?
I don't know, but I'll give you my card and you can give me an email. I can find out. Generally, this kind of stuff is 3 years. Yeah, that's a good lawyer question. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. My information's was up there. Please feel free to shoot us an email anytime.